The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to The Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
I always thought Lance was a witch, and I'm not sure how we can prove that, but
see if he floats.
I think we should try that on video sometime. Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how's it going today?
It's going great, Tim. I cannot complain. How are you?
I am doing great. I'm really excited to talk about this story today with me, you, and Jen, our friend, our coworker, Jennifer Amell. She's joining us in this episode. We're talking about the Tanganyika laughter epidemic of 1962.
And on the surface, this incident struck us as being rather creepy. It involved school children that were aged anywhere from 12 to 18 years old, all coming down with this contagious laughter that they couldn't control. That went on and on for over 2 weeks. And the more we talked about it, the more we started to unpack unexpectedly the causes of something like this and linking that to being in a stressful environment.
Yeah, it's a really wild story and just something we found interesting and wanted to talk about. And these are the kind of episodes we're going to try to do more of. So actually, if you've got a topic, feel free to email it to us, crawlspacepodcast@gmail.com, and follow us on social media. I hope you like this conversation.
And head on over to crawlspace-media.com to check out everything that goes on in the Crawlspace universe. Speaking of which, Tim, we have a new live show that is coming up on December 4th. It's going to be in Salem, Massachusetts at the Salem Waterfront Hotel, a nice intimate engagement. It's going to be a live reading of the story Sacrifice, which premiered in podcast form last December. It was from the show Stories from the In-Between. That is our fictional podcast. And the story was also published in an anthology book called Deathlehem, and it's a collection of haunted Christmas tales. The proceeds of that book went to the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation. And we thought it'd be cool to have a live event where we have the actual narrator, Sarah Sheckles, there. She's going to be reading Sacrifice and proceeds from that show, as well as book sales. The books will be on sale there. Also, will go to the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation. The link for all of that is in the show notes. Hope to see you there. Use promo code STORIES21 for $5 off.
Welcome back to Crawl Space. Jennifer Amell, how are you today?
I am doing very well. I've been laughing all day because of our subject matter for this episode.
Jen, are you ready to take a trip to Tanganyika?
Am I ever?
You always talk about Tanganyika to us, and you say that you want to build a little cottage and rent it out on Airbnb.
It really seems like a riot over there.
It does. It's nonstop laughter. What are we talking about, guys?
Today, we are talking about the Tanganyika laughter epidemic of 1962. And if you're saying, I've never heard of that, or where the heck is Tanganyika? Tanganyika was a sovereign state, and it is modern-day Tanzania, which is in East Africa.
East Africa, near the border of Uganda. But we are actually here to talk about this laughter epidemic. Like you said, this was something that happened in January of 1962, and it is creepy on numerous levels. One, this affected mostly children. The symptoms went on for up to 2 weeks or 16 days, depending on some of the accounts that are documented.
Yeah, it started with school children aged 12 to 18, and the teaching staff apparently was unaffected. And so it affected at least about 95 pupils, and then it spread. It spread to neighboring villages and towns as well, and schools.
This all started at a school, middle school for girls, right? This was a school called Ramashenyi Girls Middle School. I think we see this across episodes like this, like episodes of mass hysteria, that they kind of overwhelmingly affect the female population, which I find very interesting and will sort of unpack a little later. But this ended up spreading to numerous schools, right?
Yeah, that's right. It spread to 14 different schools. And Jen, you mentioned mass hysteria. I thought we were talking about laughter.
Yeah, well, this has kind of been branded as a mass hysteria event. And that's a little bit of a layman's term. I think we most of us have probably heard of a concept like that. But in psychology, it's known as a mass psychogenic or sociogenic illness. On Wikipedia here, there's like a brief overview of what this illness is. It is, quote, the rapid spread of illness signs and symptoms affecting members of a cohesive group originating from a nervous system disturbance involving excitation, loss, or alteration of function, whereby physical complaints that are exhibited unconsciously have no corresponding organic etiology. So all that is to say that this is a thing that doesn't really have an explanation in the body. There's no physiological symptom of something happening, but it is a psychological trigger.
Is there something that can be attributed to the cause of this, the trigger of this?
Yeah, there's been a lot of theories. I mean, I think from what I've read, it's really hard to research something like that in a kind of controlled way, I would say, because like you have an event, you can't predict an event of mass hysteria. So you're kind of going in forensically and looking at what happened, and you don't find any physiological causes, but you're kind of saying, well, if it's not all of these things, then it must be this other category, which is mass hysteria. So we don't really know what it is, but it's kind of a catch-all term.
So it's something that stems from the nervous system. Is this something that could have been influenced by stressful events that have been slowly escalating, and then whatever this unknown trigger was happens in one person and then is a domino effect to those around them?
Yeah, I would say that's a pretty accurate thing. There's this Dr. Christian F. Hempelman of Purdue University. He said that in 1962, Tanganyika had just won its independence, and students were kind of growing up in this like rapidly changing, kind of perhaps violent situation. And because of this stress and anxiety, this psychogenic illness occurred because of the outside stressors in their lives.
These outside stressors, they caused fits of laughter, fainting, flatulence, respiratory problems, rashes, crying, and screaming, though no injuries were reported that I've read. But in all, 14 schools were shut down and 1,000 people were affected. And this one school shut down once, reopened, and then closed again because of this laughing fit.
Yeah, I wonder what that would be like. I guess it was just happening in class and not at home, which speaks to this like point that you made, Lance, that you're seeing your peer have an uncontrollable laughing fit. And so it spreads to you because you're observing it in a way. It's not like these things were happening in isolation. But I imagine that's like super disrupting to the school day.
So I think it's also on top of that, Jen, it's also telling of the circumstances of the times. And even though it's 1962 and we're coming up to the 60th anniversary of that in January, do you think they were looking at that as like stress induced? Do you think they were looking at the environment and what was going on around them and saying, you know, maybe this is happening because of the circumstances that the country's going through? Or do you think maybe it was just completely, maybe they were completely baffled by the whole thing?
Yeah, I don't know at what point these researchers were positing these explanations for mass hysteria or an event like this. I don't know if they were looking exclusively at the Tanganyika laughter epidemic, but there's been so many other instances of things like this, from the Salem witch trials to there was an instance in Würzburg, Germany, where there's an outbreak of screaming, squirming, and trances in a nunnery, and that led to the execution of a witch. So it depends on the, I guess, time period of when these events took place. But I think, like, with no explanation for why this would happen, of course you would like turn to an occult or like spiritual influence for something like this. But now in our modern era, in the 60s, you would have like psychologists and sociologists looking at this through the lens of science.
Yeah, and that Christian Hempelmann that you mentioned earlier also gave another example. He said from his time living in Lafayette, Indiana, there were workers at a local DMV were exhibiting respiratory distress to the point where the building was repeatedly shut down and eventually relocated. And but they found nothing. And ultimately, the local media reported it as a case of mass psychological illness. And it's just, Hempelmann says, because it was a terrible work environment, essentially. It's funny to me that, not funny, haha, but interesting that laughter is a symptom of stress. Certainly not one of the most common ones, but it's there.
It's like a release, right? It's like a nervous system release.
Yeah.
Like a yawn.
Yeah, that happens. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but that happens to me all the time. If I'm in like super serious situations, like at a funeral or something, I have this almost like unsuppressed need to giggle or something. And it is a release of like built up stress or emotion that is like a physical symptom of something that comes from the outside. These immaterial things such as stress, anxiety, poor working conditions, stricture surrounding the school, being in a war zone, all of those things can come out in really strange ways.
I think we've probably all experienced it on a film set, whether it's a comedy movie or not, where two actors just start sort of laughing at something the other one said, and all of a sudden you got to take a break because you can't say those words or else they trigger the actors, and then sometimes they trigger the crew. And it literally has happened, I'm sure, to you guys as well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it happens on these interviews sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, we have blooper reels for a reason, right?
Right, right. And there's stress on movie sets, you know, and people are, everyone's watching, you know, you're actually trying to do your job as you're sort of laughing through it. The laughter is technically preventing you from doing your job in that moment.
Yeah, I would say that is a coping strategy that we three have too. Like on a day-to-day basis, we talk about some pretty dark stuff, missing persons, murders, you know, all this sort of thing. And like, it's not right. But in the midst of recording these things, we will break out into giggles, not because the material itself is funny, far from it, but because it's like, God, this is dark. You know, you'd have to release somehow.
It is a really interesting concept if you're thinking about it, you know, in the terms of a small scale, like you're talking about our interviews or working on a movie set, like these are small isolated incidents. And then you have the mid-level ones, like the one that we started off the episode about, where the school children start to laugh and then it affects, you know, other school children. And once you eliminate them from their school, once you remove them and now they're isolated, then it gets better. But then you put them back into that environment and it triggers again and it builds again. So there's that mid-level part. But then this is almost like the foundation for very influential people to form cults, because you can introduce mass hysteria to moral panic and then groupthink and mass psychosis, where you can use these incidents and then blame it on something. You brought up the witch trials, the Salem witch trials. So if you have this impoverished country that's going through changes that's very stressful to its citizens, and causes something like the children to start laughing because they see their parents and their teachers super stressed, and there's always stressful things that's being thrown in their faces, and they're not able to control what they're consuming visually, and it's propaganda, they get stressed, they start laughing, then that's just a doorway to these people to walk in and create this moral panic. Why are they laughing? Well, they're laughing because of whatever, right? Insert devil worshiping, insert witchcraft, and now you can start to take advantage of the situations, and not to classify individuals, but then you can, there's those in these cultures that would be more susceptible to the influence of somebody like that, maybe somebody who has lost a parent or something.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there, at least in the Wikipedia page, there was a sociologist called Robert Bartholomew alongside of a psychiatrist, Simon Wesley. And they actually looked at the culture-specific aspects involved in the Tanganyika laughter epidemic. And they looked at like what was happening in Africa as a whole in the 1960s. And they saw like many instances of like these smaller missionary schools in East Africa that were traditionally run by elders who were like super strict and had a very conservative way of running things. This kind of cultural dissonance, they said, of like modernism coming to Africa at that time. And like those two things chafing up against each other is what kind of gave birth to these, what's called conversion reactions. And that's an interesting thing in itself, conversion disorder. Have you guys ever heard of that?
No.
It's a lot like the mass hysteria concept, but it's seen a lot in different pain conditions. For example, there's something that happens called a pseudo seizure or a non-epileptic seizure. So it's like a person looks like they're having a seizure. They have all outward symptoms of a seizure, but they don't have the same electrical disruptions in their brain as a normal seizure does. So like for all intents and purposes, like this is like a completely psychologically triggered physiological event, but they're just as real as like regular electrical seizures. So conversion disorder is kind of playing on something like that, where something happens in your mind or from outside stressors and like causes a physiological thing to happen.
How does that differ from a panic attack or an anxiety attack?
I'm sure it does. Like technically, I'm not a psychologist, so I can't point to the difference there, but it's probably along the same lines. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you look at that, then you look at the situation that somebody was in or was going through when they had their panic attack or panic attacks, and you can see how that could translate in a couple of different ways. It, you know, someone could have instead had a uncontrollable bout of laughter in the middle of a supermarket because of stress, or you know, instead they have this panic attack or this you know, have conversion disorder.
Yeah, and I think like what makes mass hysteria so interesting is that we're getting to a place where like mental health issues are more talked about now, but that's kind of an intimate experience when you have a panic attack or like have some sort of anxiety disorder or a mood disorder. But what's interesting about this is that it happens in one and then spreads to others. I think that's why different researchers have looked to like the cultural context of what's happening to explain how so many people could have the same physiological symptoms from a context of like psychological triggers.
Yeah, that makes sense. And It just keeps reminding me of the witch trials, not only in Salem, but the witch trials in Scotland and historically just the witch trials throughout history, and how hysteria was always classified as something that was only in women because of some sort of like imbalance of fluids or chemicals, like chemical fluids in their bodies. And that, of course, has to be related to a witch, because then they have to run the parallel to religion, because it can't be something at the time diagnosed medically.
Right. I think there was definitely a through line, at least for women involved in these sorts of things, of like it happening because of some moral reason, you know. But if it's divorced from morality, like because you weren't living in a Christian way or because you committed adultery or whatever the hell the reason was, it was like the influence of the devil or she's a witch or something like that. But now I think researchers have posited the theory that a lot of mass hysteria comes out of populations who have been historically oppressed. And we know that women have been historically repressed, especially in societies like Salem, where you had the kind of puritanical rule. But yeah, as we look down the list of these different mass hysteria events, like a lot of them are women or are people living in situations where they don't feel like they have any power.
I always thought Lance was a witch, and I'm not sure how we can prove that, but
see if he floats.
I think we should try that on video sometime.
There's a number of ways we can run some diagnostics. Well, Jen, you said you said people who don't have power or with power?
People who don't have power.
Right. So, I mean, what do you think of then when you, and this is, not in relation to the female aspect to it, but what do you think of then when you think of mass hysteria and groupthink and the moral panic, when you think of a group of people who don't have power, who just lost power, who are now caught up in this mass hysteria or moral panic and embark on something very dangerous?
Are you talking about cults or religion?
Well, I'm talking about the Third Reich and Nazis, how they lost everything, and that was used to generate a groupthink mentality to assemble an army, to conquer the world.
Yeah, I guess there's some parallels there. I mean, I think that was part of Hannah Arendt's argument in her Banality of Evil treatise, like on how the Nazis came to power. And it for sure was based out of this like fear-mongering ideology, like initially, and then kind of morphed into this like Germans are the greatest nation on earth, the greatest race on earth, that sort of thing. So I think like it divorces at some point from this mass hysteria thing, but yeah, it definitely has its roots in that.
See, my whole goal with this conversation is to take it as far down paths that at the end we can say, wait, we started off with laughing kids because it was just kind of a creepy article that popped up.
Right.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Rex Heuermann is a demon that walks among us, a predator that ruined families.
The LISC, Long Island Serial Killer podcast, was shocked when the news broke of Rex Heuermann's arrest. After more than a decade of searching, law enforcement officials had finally pieced together enough evidence to bring formal charges against Rex Heuermann. Initially charged with 3 murders, Heuermann is now officially charged with all 4 deaths in the Gilgo 4 case. I'm your host, Chris Moss, and the LISC podcast will be releasing new episodes with interviews and fresh insight on the case as Rex Heuermann awaits trial in Long Island. While we are relieved by the arrest, the LISC podcast team will be working hard to share new developments and perspectives as we get them. So please keep your eyes and ears out for new episodes, and if you haven't already, please listen to seasons 1 and 2 of LISC, Long Island Serial Killer, wherever you listen to podcasts.
How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season 1 that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, but wait, there's more to the story. And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hares from season 1, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program. Well, I think the mystery of the effects of stress on a human body seems like a mystery for the ages. I mean, really, right? Like, sometimes there's just no rhyme or reason to how stress affects a person.
Yeah, I agree. And it's like, how does oppression play a role in that? It's like, if you historically have not had a voice, or like, even if you've screamed from the rooftops that you deserve the right to vote, or, you know, whatever, your cause may be, I think, like, a more headline catching way to get attention on yourself is to do consciously or unconsciously to do something like this that you can't ignore, like a laughter epidemic. And tied into that is, like, it's not just one person who is uncontrollably laughing in this case, and in many other cases, it's like a whole group of oppressed people. So together doing something as strange as laughing uncontrollably, they're like drawing attention to themselves. It's not the most direct approach to, you know, talking about what's wrong in your society, but it definitely gets attention.
I don't know if I've mentioned it before, but and I didn't even think I was going to mention it on this particular episode, but it is it speaks to what we are discussing. I've been reading different excerpts of this book called The Malleus Maleficarum, which is a book that was, I don't even know if you could call it a book. It's a guidebook that was written in the 1400s. It's been translated a couple of times, and it is translated as The Witch's Hammer. And it's two religious figures who wrote this instructional, like, manual on what to do in the case that you encounter a witch. And they're very influential people in their time. And they cited examples that, when you're reading it, sounds incredible. Like how a priest was approached by a young man who said that his genitals had been removed. They're gone. It's just totally, totally blank. And it was after he met this woman. And then the priest says, well, you've been bewitched and you need to go beg for whatever you need to beg for to get your genitals back. And then the priest swears to God that the individual did what he told him to do, came back and saw with his own eyes that his genitals had returned. And I know that little cut right there will probably make a rap song later on. but these are very influential individuals who put this in there as fact. And I mean, we know now that that's not true. That didn't happen. And it was probably something that was lost in translation through different writings, where maybe the man's libido wasn't there. Maybe he had some sort of ED, you know, and was simply saying, like, I've lost the ability to use my to use my you know, my manhood.
Go on.
Digging. No, but you know what I mean? Like, maybe he's impotent. He's trying to figure out, like, why, and who do you go to at that time? Like, you're not going to a doctor. You're not going to wait in a waiting room. You're not going to, like, forhims.com. Yes. Like, you're going to your priest.
And, I was just going to say, you're going to go to forhims.com.
Yeah. Like, so that's probably where it was lost in translation. And they have this hysteria of witchcraft, and he probably felt ashamed that he wasn't able to perform with a woman, and went to the priest and said, I got nothing down there. And it was took literally.
Yeah, if you pull back on that a little bit, what I see out of that anecdote is that, so you have this oppressed group of people, women generally, although men were also accused of witchcraft too, but you have this oppressed group of people, and then you have these witch hunters who are part of the oppressive group trying to take back the power by fighting witchcraft. It's all kind of an allegory for a power struggle.
Sounds like book 7 of the Harry Potter series.
Harry Potter and the Malleus Malficarum.
Harry Potter and the missing junk. Yep.
Well, personally, I remember one time laughing while being in the presence of a family member who was giving a blood transfusion, and I couldn't be in the room. The nurse kicked me out because I was giggling. They said I was apparently close to passing out based on my reaction of just laughter, which I was just like, you know, giggly and just thought it was funny. And they were like, no, get out of this room right now.
I would say that that's probably something that is in the top. It might be number one for nurses to like as a indicator. You know, if this person's in the room and they start laughing, get them out. Like that's probably in like the top three warning signs to get somebody out.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, people have a whole bunch of like strange physiological things that happen to them when they're under a lot of stress. This makes me think of like how the true crime community looks at people who are suspected of crimes and like their reaction to their loved one's death or their friend's death. Like, oh, they didn't cry, so they must be guilty. Or, oh, they laughed, so they must be guilty. And that's just not the case. Like grief is, it comes out in strange ways.
It's interesting you mentioned that we're working on a secret project, a top secret project here, but I will reference a moment in that top secret project where a gentleman learned of his wife's death and continued to do, I mean, his wife was there and continued to do the business that he needed to do, which was write a check to somebody so that they could go and pay off a contractor. In between calling for the police and for the ambulance while he was waiting, continued to write the check and wanted to make sure that check went to the contractor. And people looked at that and said, well, that's very suspicious. Like, why would he continue to do that? And he probably to this day can't answer in any other way than that was something I knew I needed to do. And it is interesting where stress would take you psychologically when you don't know what you should do. And this individual operated construction yards and contracting and had a very high stress job. But, you know, in his brain, just based on his work, things always added up. You put this here and it goes here. Like it's always like square corners and blueprints and measuring twice. And that probably felt better for him knowing like, well, I came home to do this. I got to finish this. I can't bring my wife back, but at least I can finish this.
Yeah, it sounds like shock. Like
yeah,
he just kind of reverted to his like tasks he did almost by rote. It's like, well, these are the things I set out to do today. And like, oh my God, here's this like horrible thing that happened that I can't even look at right now. So I'm just going to keep going down the line of tasks to do. But it's yeah, I mean, like this larger conversation of like how really stressful or traumatic situations can affect you is like so important to have. Because it's interesting, like in Western medicine, the mind and the body are viewed as two separate things, like hence why we have MDs and psychiatrists or psychologists, you know, we think of these things in like very, very separate ways, but that's not so in a lot of Eastern traditions. They're looked at as like two systems that interface together. So of course, if you were looking at this through like an Eastern perspective, like of course, stress within a culture would cause a group of young students to uncontrollably laugh. Like it wouldn't be strange from that lens.
Mass hysteria today, is it different in the age of social media?
I mean, it's totally different in the age of social media because that's just a way to distribute your propaganda. And maybe we can talk about this without getting too political, but if you're looking at social media, that's just a faster system to deliver propaganda if your intent is to cause a moral panic. And what society would you be trying to impose a moral panic on that you know you can be successful, and it's one that has some cracks in the foundation for whatever reason, and maybe it's a warning sign like what happened in Tanganyika with children laughing hysterically for no reason. There's your sign that this society, this community is stressed. So if you have that fast, accelerated delivery system of propaganda, where are you going to deliver that to a country or a society or a culture that seems to be strong and has everything together, both socially and economically? Or are you going to try to infiltrate a society or culture that has some flaws, some cracks, and they're working it out?
Right, because the laughter epidemic ultimately was contagious. So there's some contagious aspect to this. And if you're not together physically, you can still be together electronically via social media.
Absolutely. And think about something being contagious, a contagion. Do you catch anything when you're not influenced by the thing that has that particular symptom? No. Don't be around people whose symptoms include laughter, and you probably won't start laughing uncontrollably yourself.
And 18 months after the laughter epidemic began, it started to die off.